Today's conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ms. Hendricks, you may begin.
Thanks. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the first term telecon of 2008. I'm pleased to be sitting here with Don Mitchell from Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab outside Baltimore, Maryland. And he's going to be talking with us today about energetic particles and Saturn's rotating magnetosphere. Don is a member of the Cassini-MIMI team, which he will be talking about today, and has a lot of experience and interest in working with energetic neutral atom imaging in the solar system, both in Saturn system and I think in the Jupiter system and elsewhere. So so I guess without further ado, we'll go ahead and have Don get started.
Okay, hello everyone. If you've all got the first page of this thing up, it shows a series of images of Saturn's magnetosphere, which I'll actually return to later, so I'm not going to explain it now, but this is one rotation in the life of Saturn's magnetosphere as imaged in energetic neutral atoms. So I'll go on then to the following slide, which shows the spacecraft and various instruments on it, and if you have the PowerPoint version, you will have seen a couple of pop-ups where the INCA and the CHEMS and LEMS sensors are circled. The INCA is on a standalone bracket on the side of the spacecraft, and this is the ion and neutral camera. It's one of the three sensors that make up the MIMI instrument, and that's the one that does the energetic neutral atom imaging. And then there are the CHEMS and LEMS sensors, which are both in-situ charged particle instruments. They measure the charged energetic ions and electrons in the vicinity of the spacecraft. So now we'll move on. The next slide just is a reminder of the system we're looking at, and not the part that I'm going to talk about so much, but these are the moons above, with most prominently Titan and then the large icy moons and then some rocks. And below you see the layout in the inner magnetosphere. What's the inner magnetosphere for me? It's the ring system for Saturn and the rings folks. And where some of the icy moons lie in it, and in particular the relationship of the E-ring to the moon Enceladus, which I'm sure you've heard quite a lot about in the past, and it's an important aspect of the magnetospheric environment for us. Moving to the next slide, this is just a slide which describes very broad brush what the magnetosphere is composed of. It's this large magnetic bubble surrounding the planet Saturn. Each magnetized planet has one. It's the region dominated by the planet's magnetic field and around which the solar wind blows. For Saturn, there's a very complex interaction between the icy satellites and rings of Saturn and the plasma that's trapped in the magnetic field. Also the neutral gases in that region and of course the solar wind which shapes the outer reaches of the magnetosphere. In particular, Enceladus, with its strong emission of water into the magnetosphere at about 4 Saturn radii, dominates the neutral and ionized gas populating the magnetosphere inside 10 RF and actually a large part of the plasma in the outer magnetosphere as well, although there are also atmospheric and ionospheric contributions in the outer region, a little bit of solar wind contribution as well. Typical constituents are water product constituents with a little methane and, of course, some solar wind, hydrogen also from the solar wind and helium double plus, although not much of that. Unlike in the case of Earth, for example, where the solar wind is probably makes up half the content of the magnetosphere. Moving on, this is Enceladus again, as I said, very important to us, and particularly because of the jets that are emanating from the south polar region. They put out both the micron-sized ice particles that make up the E-ring, but also, more importantly, to the magnetosphere, large quantities of gas, water products that provide both the neutral gas, which is very important to the evolution and condition of the magnetosphere, and also the most prominent source of ionized particles in the magnetosphere of the plasma. So the next slide shows a schematic that was put together by the magnetometer team, Michelle Dougherty, in science, back in 2006, and it shows the gas neutral cloud coming out of the south end of Enceladus and deforming, because it's ionizing in place, it deforms the magnetic field in the vicinity of the moon, and that was really how the magnetometer team was able to pin down the fact that this cloud existed, and then other teams jumped in and found more evidence for it. Again, the next slide shows the same figure, and it also shows some measurements from the CAPS plasma team that show that indicate that there's the plasma inside of about 10 Saturn radii, and in this diagram, the radius is shown in decreasing from large radii to small radii as time goes from left to right. You see that inside of about 9 or 10 Saturn radii, there's a very strong increase in the density of ions, water product ions, relative to hydrogen. And in fact, that continues much further out in the magnetosphere. The cutoff in this figure was really more of a latitude cutoff, it turns out, than a radial distance cutoff. And so if you stay in the equatorial plane, that dominance of water products is maintained considerably further out in the magnetosphere. So again, without Enceladus, Saturn's magnetosphere would be a very different place, probably hydrogen-dominated and not water product dominated, and the mass of the ions makes a lot of difference as to how the magnetosphere behaves.
So that's really interesting to me, though, that, and maybe you're going to talk about this, I don't want to interrupt too much, but that Titan isn't more important relative. I mean,
yeah.
Enceladus is really turning out to be the important.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Titan was expected to be a much more important source of material for the magnetosphere. Certainly much further out in the magnetosphere in a very dense atmosphere, but it turns out not to be. There was expectation that there'd be a considerable amount of nitrogen in the magnetosphere, and there's very, very little nitrogen. There's a lot of oxygen, which, again, is coming from Enceladus. I don't think anybody anticipated coming into this how strong a source Enceladus was and how weak a source that Titan would turn out to be. So the next slide is rather complicated, and I'm not going to go through it in gory detail, but it shows a schematic of what our kind of understanding of Saturn's magnetosphere was coming into the Cassini mission, and it's substantially held up. There's some tweaks that need to be done to this figure, but it's not too far off. So it shows the inner part of the system dominated by this dust and gas from Enceladus, and then the Titan influence on the magnetosphere is probably overstated in this figure. It shows this Titan neutral torus in kind of a violet color. And as far as we can tell, that neutral torus really isn't there, or if it's there, it's very weak. And the hot plasma, which is shown in red, is shown to be it's trapped on the magnetic field, and it extends out into a large sheet and is shaped in the outer part of the magnetosphere by the magnetopause, which is the current sheet that separates the solar wind from the internal, the magnetic field dominated magnetosphere. There are a lot more elements here which I just don't want to clutter your minds too much with, but the one thing that indicated that I will point out is the ring current, which is a current that flows in the equatorial plane around Saturn in the direction indicated by the arrow in the sort of middle lower part of this diagram. And that current is carried by the plasma in the system. It deforms the magnetic field, and it's a very important part of the whole magnetospheric system, the way it's unique at Saturn. And we'll go ahead and get into that a lot more.
And it looks from this slide like that current extends from within the main ring system all the way out almost to Titan?
It does look like that here, but it doesn't actually do that.
Oh, okay.
and that's part of the inaccuracy of this diagram. At the time of the Voyager flybys, it was thought that the that the energetic particle population basically went all the way up to the ring edge, and in some energy ranges that's still true. At the very high energies there is a, there's a trapped particle population that goes all the way into the ring edges, and the rings, of course, inside the rings it's empty because the rings absorb all the particles. But in fact, in the ring current energy range, which actually there are two energies, and I'll get into that a little more later, but in the energetic particle range which I'm talking about, which tends to be from sort of 10 kilovolts hydrogen up to several hundred kilovolts, there, the region inside of about 6 RS is almost empty of those particles, and that's because the gas density from Enceladus is so high that charge exchange losses, the ions pick up electrons from that neutral gas, and once they pick up an electron and become a neutral, they are no longer magnetically trapped and just leave the system. And that loss process is so much stronger than the source processes of those particles that they just can't survive in that region, and so it's really quite empty of those particles. So the ring current sort of ends at about 7 RF or so, effectively. So the next slide, again, just emphasizes one more time how important Enceladus is. This shows a view of Enceladus which is exposed such that you can see the E-ring quite well, and you can see that almost the active contribution of Enceladus to the E-ring. It certainly peaks at the orbit of Enceladus and then it diffuses away from that by random motion of the particles. And the gas does pretty much the same thing. It's a distribution of gas, looks very much like the distribution of the E-ring, except it's a little bit more extended in the direction perpendicular to the equatorial plane, so that it goes above and below the equatorial plane a bit more than the E-ring particles do. So the next slide shows the gas jets from Enceladus, just a reminder, the water product plasma, and then the gas cloud as imaged by the UVIS measurement instrument on Cassini. This is UV emission from the oxygen in the gas cloud, and so you can see its relationship to Saturn and the rings and so on, and it dominates the inner part of the magnetosphere. The next slide is a different view of the magnetic field, much more sketchy, but it shows where the trapped low-energy plasma in the field lies, reaching from... The low-energy plasma does go well in all the way to the ring edge because it doesn't get lost by charge exchange. It does charge exchange with the cold neutral gas, but it comes from the cold neutral gas. So as charge exchange occurs and an ion is lost, it leaves behind a cold ion. That ion gets swept up in the rotating magnetic field and brought up to the same energy as the rest of the ions in the inner magnetosphere. And so it's basically exchanging particles, and there's no net loss or gain in that process. So the plasma can at the very low energies can exist quite comfortably in that region and just go through this constant turnover in the identity of the actual particles that are there at any given time. There's this sort of disc-like, if you look at this as an object of revolution, that the magnetic field sort of forms a disc. There's a sheet of current, which is the ring current, and evolves into the tail current on the night side. And the other part of this diagram, which I want you to pay attention to, is the arrow that shows rotation, because unlike the case of the Earth, rotation is a very important part of the dynamics of this system, and show more evidence for that in a bit. So going on, this is the data we got during the Saturn orbit injection, which shows just a spectrogram of energetic particles. Energy is in the vertical dimension, time going horizontally, and I've shown a few fiducials for radial distance on the bottom. See, we were across in and out of 6 RS distance, and of course between those two arrows we're at lower altitudes. Inside of that, the energetic particles are simply gone, and that's where the water product cloud is. If you click it again, you see the diagram that I showed you earlier of the UV emissions of the water product cloud, and that's basically where it fits into this diagram. And it's this cloud that is eating away those energetic particles, not allowing them to exist there. So then, if we move on again,
I'm sorry. Can you go back?
Sure.
Back to slide 12.
Mm-hmm.
So inside 6RS, you've got a lot of neutrals,
mm-hmm.
and not energetic particles because they're getting eaten up by the neutrals. But what's happening out of the lobe then?
Good question. It looks like another gap in the energetic particle population that sits around three-quarters of the way across the diagram to the right, and it's labeled the lobe. This is where the spacecraft was climbing in latitude and went out of that disc-like structure that I talked before into the magnetic field that's above that, which contains very few particles. That region is essentially doesn't close through the equatorial plane. These magnetic field lines connect out into the solar wind, and any particles that get onto them can simply stream along the magnetic field and escape the system. So the lobes are typically empty of energetic particles in any magnetosphere, and the equatorial region tends to be full of energetic particles. So that's not an unusual characteristic for any magnetosphere to have.
If you had stayed at the same latitude all the way out, then
yep.
you wouldn't have seen a dropout in the energetic particles.
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
Now, however, it brightens up again in this region labeled substorm, and there are dynamics going on. It's not a static kind of a place. I mean, in addition to the rotation, there are sort of sporadic dynamics going on. And as in Earth, where we have substorms in the magnetotail, we labeled this a substorm. Whether it's really exactly the same phenomenon or not, we're not sure at this point. But certainly there was a reconfiguration of the magnetic field and an energization of particles. And this happens, but the analog at Earth is called a substorm. It's where this current sheet, there's a breakdown an instability that goes off in the current in the current sheet. A phenomenon called reconnection goes on. This releases energy which has been stored in the current and in the stretched, distended magnetic fields. The fields relax and become more like dipolar fields. So you effectively move, even though the spacecraft is still climbing in latitude, the current sheet all of a sudden expands over it. So you see, because it's relaxed, that you see that the content of the current sheet show up at higher latitudes when this phenomenon goes up.
So doesn't that, I mean, that's at 20 RS, which is also where Titan is,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't have anything to do with Titan in this case?
Probably not.
Okay.
Titan, one researcher, Chris Russell, has postulated that Titan does affect the frequency of substorms, and that you get more substorms when Titan is in the tail region. You may be right. I think that's something that we'll be looking at closely.
Mm-hmm.
So, moving on from this. This is just a diagram attributed to Stan Cowley, which looks at a cut through the equatorial plane of the magnetosphere and looks at the flows of the plasma. And it shows that close to Saturn, the flow of the plasma is rotational. It's rotating about the planet, and this is because the magnetic field has its foot points in the ionosphere of Saturn. That ionosphere is spinning with the atmosphere, and there's an electric field that's created in that motion, which is translated along the magnetic field out to the plasma in the equatorial plane and cranks it up to the same rotational velocity as the foot points of the magnetic field. So the whole magnetosphere rotates, essentially connected, coupled to the ionosphere of Saturn. And this happens at Jupiter even more strongly. It happens at Earth, but it's a much slower, 24-hour rotation, whereas this is just under 11 hours rotation period in a much bigger system, so the velocities are much larger here, and it's a much bigger factor in the flow patterns of the particles at Saturn than it is at Earth. But at Jupiter, it's probably even more dominant than it is at Saturn. You go far enough out in the system, and on the day side, you run into the magnetopause, this separation current that separates the solar wind from the internal magnetosphere. and the core rotation stops there because the ionosphere has no influence on the solar wind out there. It's not magnetically connected anymore. And on the night side, there's also a breakdown. It's basically you're getting out into such a long lever arm in the connection from the ionosphere to the equatorial plane that the torques exerted by other forces, again, mostly dominated by the solar wind flow, end up being stronger than the torques that the ionosphere can exert, and so the flow patterns break down and change direction. But there's this very large region going all the way up to Titan's orbit, which is typically rotation-dominated, and even much further than that, as we'll see. So just wanted to impress upon you how much of this system is rotating and connected to the ionosphere. The next is a diagram from a science paper that's just showing the atmosphere, and you have to imagine the ionosphere above this. It's there. It's just not imageable. But there's some slippage between the atmosphere. It's a sort of friction between the atmosphere and the ionosphere that causes the ionosphere to rotate, and the ionosphere then causes the magnetosphere to rotate. Each of those couplings may have a little bit of slippage in them. It's like a slippy clutch in a car or something. And so you don't necessarily expect the magnetosphere to rotate exactly at the same velocity the atmosphere rotates. So if we go on to the next slide, you'll see a profile of the atmospheric rotation curve as a function of latitude. This is mostly in the southern hemisphere where we've been getting most of the data. And you see this pattern of different flow speeds. These are jets at different of the atmosphere at different latitudes. We don't see this pattern imposed on the magnetosphere. And part of the question we have is, or at least we haven't resolved it if it is, and so the slippy clutch is sort of integrating out this defined structure in the atmospheric jet. The next slide shows some relevant rotation velocities plotted against the atmospheric rotation curve, so that again the jets are represented by the data symbols as well as the line on this plot, and then in broadly the colored vertical band shows the range within which the rotation of the magnetosphere has been pinned down. The Voyager period is on the right edge of that band, and that's based on SKR, that's Saturn kilometric radiation, and I'll talk more about that in just a moment. But you see that the left-hand side of that band is also determined by Saturn kilometric radiation period, but from Cassini, and Ulysses got intermediate values. So part of the puzzle has been the variation that we see in this, and then more recently, Anderson and Goldreich have, based upon radio science data, have derived a rotation period for the interior of Saturn, which is quite different from that of the magnetospheric period. So this shows that the interior is only loosely coupled to the magnetosphere. Going on, this shows the how the SKR data has been used to derive the rotation periods for Saturn. The Voyager on the is the shorter period, and then during the Cassini era, we've gotten longer periods for the rotation of Saturn. The SKR data in the upper left of the black box shows that it is just a series of repeating bursts, and they're irregular, but if you look at them over a very long period of time, there's a very well-defined frequency that falls out, and that's the frequency that was for a long time used as a proxy for the internal rotation rate of Saturn, and it's been within the Cassini era and a little bit before that with Ulysses, where it's been indicated that this is not really a constant, it's a varying frequency, and so can't possibly be what the internal rotation rate of Saturn is, since the angular momentum conservation would require that to be much more steady than what we've seen from this measure of rotation. The next diagram is one I'm not going to go through in any detail. It's just a summary of the rotation period measurements that have come out since the 1980s and to the present. And the period, whether you look at it in hours, minutes, seconds, or in fractional hours, is right around 10.8, but it's actually changed anywhere from 10.3 or so up to 10.9 or so. So there's quite a bit of variability. Part of that is measurements error, and part of that is true variability. The next slide shows the evolution of that period over the course of the Cassini mission. And so even over the course of the Cassini mission, there's been enough variation in the rotation rate so that the SKR data couldn't be fit with one particular frequency. So using that information, the team led by Don Granata and Bill Curth at Iowa used the SKR data to derive a polynomial fit to that curve and to derive a coordinate system that represented what the instantaneous day-to-day rotation rate of Saturn is over the course of the mission so far. And you can use this then as a variable coordinate system to organize all the rest of the observations that we make in the magnetosphere. Some of them are well organized by it and some aren't, but a lot of the energetic particles tend to be well organized by it, and that's what I want to continue with. That was, I guess, what, slide 19. We'll go on to the next slide. This is some magnetic field data from Voyager, where it was first realized that this rotation modulation of magnetospheric quantities was not restricted to just the SKR radiation, but was also in the magnetic field in the middle of the magnetosphere. The next slide is a diagram, and if you're on PowerPoint, you can click it twice. A diagram of this, what's called the camshaft model, that was derived from that magnetic field data, which postulates that there is, in the inner magnetosphere, a kind of a stiff part of the plasma that goes around like a camshaft and is tied tightly to Saturn's ionosphere and rotates therefore with Saturn and disturbs the rest of the magnetosphere outside of that camshaft region as it rotates around. Part of what this diagram indicates is that the rest of the magnetosphere is labeled as sub-co-rotating, and what that means is that if you measure the velocity of the plasma in the magnetosphere, it's rotating around Saturn always, but it's rotating at a speed that is slower than this period that's indicated by the SKR radiation. So if you were hooked to that plasma, you'd get a longer rotation period by quite a bit. It'd be 11 and a half or 12 hours rotation period rather than 10.8 hours rotation period. So this camshaft going around at 10.8 hours, the rest of the magnetosphere plasma is going around slower than that, but this thing's causing a ripple in the rest of the plasma, and that ripple actually is pretty substantial and ends up affecting the energy of the plasma that's flowing slower than it is, and producing currents in the magnetosphere that rotate around with this cam. Right now, we don't have a more sophisticated model than this to model this stuff. It's a kind of a cartoon model. But
where is that camshaft? What RS?
Well, good question. We actually, let me go on to the next slide to try to answer that. This shows in the top view. This is now in Saturn longitude, in a Saturn longitude system, so it goes around 360 degrees around the planet. You can see the organization of the SKR intensity, and you see this kind of a sine wave in the top panel, a sine wave of the Saturn kilometric radiation, and that's kind of what defined this system in the first place. It's not too surprising that fits it well. But then the next one down shows the magnitude of one of the components of the magnetic field vector, and you see that it's also well organized. Now, you've got a radial, this is data that Don Granat from Iowa put together. He's got a radial distance range on the magnetic field perturbation, and that runs from 3 Saturn radii, which is about as far in as we can measure it, because we don't go inside of that with this spacecraft very often, out to 12 Saturn radii. It's well organized by this system up to 12 Saturn radii. Beyond 12, it does something very different, and that's a puzzle that I'm going to talk about a little bit, but not a lot, because we have to spend probably 2 more charm telecons talking about that one. Then the third panel shows the electron density, and you see that the electron density is also well organized by this. Now, this is probably getting to the guts of where the CAM is coming from. This is not just electron density, but it's also ion density. It's a net neutral plasma, so electron density is a proxy for the ion density. But this is organized well between the distances of 3 and 5 RS. So this is much more restricted. If you go beyond 5 RS, the electron density, the plasma density, is not well organized by this system, yet the magnetic field is much further out. So this is likely much closer to the core of the CAM that we're talking about. This is a density enhancement that's essentially traveling around at this rotation speed. Now, at these low latitudes means close equatorial crossing distances in a dipole field. This plasma is connected very tightly with the ionosphere. The coupling tends to be strong at low latitudes and weaker at higher latitudes. So the atmosphere and ionosphere can exert a much more rigid coupling to the plasma close to the planet, which this is, and keep it locked in the rotation period of the ionosphere. Further out, as I mentioned, the plasma is going slower than that, but this part's not. This part's rotating fast, right, with the same period as the SKR. And so this is like a pressure bulge on one side of the planet that's moving around with the planet, and maybe the source of this ripple that goes off through the rest of the magnetosphere.
So on this lower panel, you're measuring electrons in the 3 to 5 RS region.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that where we didn't have a lot of electrons? Or these have a different energy range?
Yes, it's where we don't have the high energy stuff.
Oh, okay.
But this is the low energy plasma that, as I mentioned,
okay,
is the stuff that's perfectly happy to be there, because it's actually it's being created from the gas cloud that Enceladus is putting out. Enceladus puts out this gas cloud, sunlight ionizes the gas, and so it's created in place, and it's cold. It's
okay.
Not hot plasma.
Gotcha, okay.
Okay, it's confusing. It is. But there's a very, very large range of energies we're talking about here, and the behavior at the low energy is really very different from the behavior at high energy. So moving on, this is a cartoon of the model that Don Gurnett put forward based on the data that was shown in the previous slide, and it shows again this disk rotating with Saturn. Of course, inside it's got kind of a hole in the middle, and that hole in the middle is where the rings are, and there's no plasma at all in there. But outside the rings, there's this disk rotating around, and he's showing outflow at one particular longitude. And if you look at the next slide, that diagram is repeated, and then there's a sort of an equatorial cut through that diagram as he envisions it, with outflow on one side and presumably inflow on the other side, and then these circulation cells, which are like eddy vortices based upon that flow of the plasma out on one side. And there's a complicated process by which that flow is maintained, but basically as plasma runs around those eddies, on the inside where they're running towards the outflow region, it's the part of the eddy that is closest to Saturn, there's more addition of material in that region because the full gas density is higher in that region, and so sunlight ionization will produce more plasma in that region. So on the Saturn side of those eddies, there's mass being added to those eddies, and that tends to make it then swing, and by centripetal acceleration, it gets flung out and outflows through the outflow channel. And this whole pattern then rotates with Saturn, and this outflow channel presumably is the CAM. But there's a lot of dots to connect before we can pin that down. Again, we're at the cartoon level of physics for this stuff right now. And the next diagram is just a pretty diagram. This is one that Margie Kibbleson from UCLA put together in a science article. And in this article, she doesn't go into her model too much, but one of the points that she has talked about in presentations about this is that what she's demonstrating in this diagram is simply that Enceladus is so important to the magnetosphere, a point I've tried to make as well, but that her model also says there's a special place in the ionosphere, a special longitude in the ionosphere that has a different conductivity, a higher conductivity than the rest of the ionosphere, which would account for this preference for a particular longitude in this rotating system. Of course, right now we don't have any idea how such a conductivity anomaly could be maintained.
Is that maybe some sort of atmospheric storm or something?
It could be, and that's something yes, I mean, it's definitely a possibility. Nobody's made such a correlation. I think there's a lot of cross-instrument analysis that's going to have to be done to try to establish the correlations that you're talking about, and you simply haven't reached that point. We're still trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on. Just one last model I wanted to mention. It's actually not in press yet, but it's been submitted and it's been presented in meetings by Karana, also at UCLA, which tries to take the model by the various models that I've shown you previous to this and integrate them into a model that explains some of the energetic particle behavior. And in this diagram, what it shows is this asymmetric population of energetic particles which are rotating with the planet, and involvement from the magnetotail, where the instabilities in the magnetic field tend to be more ripe for particle acceleration. And so he's trying to establish a link between acceleration mechanisms in the magnetotail, very common to all magnetized planets, and this rotational modulation. It's a long convoluted connection, but there's some evidence that it exists. And so again, one of the mysteries is how a cam rotating down at 3 to 5 RS can cause things out at, as you will see, out as far as 40 and 60 RF to be modulated at the same rotation period. That's just very hard to do coupling through the whole magnetosphere, but it's a fact. So you have to try to connect all the regions. So in the next section of what I wanted to talk about, I think you can skip the stuff at the top of this slide and just go to the bottom. I'm going to be talking about the typical behavior of energetic particles in the tail current sheet. So that was the tail region on the previous slide. The high latitude extension of those populations, because there's some interesting, again, these things have to be connected to the ionosphere through their high latitude extensions of the field. And so not everything is happening in the current sheet, and we can get some important clues at the higher latitude extensions of the magnetic fields. And then the appearance of low altitude accelerated ion and electron beams in the tail. These are associated with the aurora, which is also going to be tied up in this whole story. And reconnection accelerated electron particle jetting and acceleration. That's a long way of saying basically the substorm type phenomena that I was talking about before, where you get reconfiguration of the magnetic field, the relaxation of stresses in the field, which are translated into heating of the particles. And we can see those. The next figure, which is slide 28, shows three panels. The top one is energetic electrons. The second one is sort of medium energy protons. And the third one is the magnetic field strength. And you can see little wiggles in the magnetic field strength. And now the scale here is there are vertical dotted lines which show distance from the planet in Saturn radii. So you see this data is going much further out to 40 Saturn radii and beyond. And The only thing I want you to take away from this is that there are wiggles there, and those wiggles, as you might expect, are at this rotation period of the planet. And they're ubiquitous, so we just see them every time we go out in the tail. That same pattern is there. So, this moving to the next slide, this summarizes an analysis that was done of those wiggles for 2 years' worth of data, and you can see that there are some of the periods that are at longer periods than the rotation of Saturn as determined by the Saturn telemetric radiation, which is the solid horizontal line, but that most of the data is actually lying just about on that line. And it's actually a function of the signal to noise that we see in that wiggle. When the wiggle is well established and we get a good signal to noise on the analysis of the frequencies associated with the wiggles and the particle data, they line up right with the SKR period. And this is, again, in this period, in this distance from 20 Saturn radii out to 60 Saturn radii, so much further from the planet, and yet that same period is going on. And if we, in the next slide, slide 30, lie that data down into the equatorial plane in a coordinate system that's determined again by the Saturn telemetric radiation. We've done this for various epochs during 2006, 50-day epoch, and you see that the data lies roughly on the same spiral pattern in the equatorial plane. So if you were to look at this, if you were to sit at any particular radius, which is a circle in each of these diagrams, you'd see that same period clocking along. You'd see it coming around once per rotation. You'd get a data point. But if you look at them as a function of radius, they're not lying on a radial. They're lying on a spiral. So there's like a lag in the appearance of the peak of the particle intensities the further and further you get out in the system. And that data was all organized by the same spiral up until day 200 of 2006, and then after day 200, the spiral jumped to a different location. This sort of puzzled us, but I think this can be explained by differences between the two hemispheres, the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere, because all the data up until day 200 and including day 200 was taken when the spacecraft was pretty close to the equatorial plane, and because of the solar wind pressure on the magnetosphere, the equator of the magnetic field, the equatorial position of the current sheet in the tail, is actually displaced away from the geographic equator by the solar wind pressure. Whereas southern summer on Saturn, the solar wind is coming basically from the same direction as the sun. It's blowing from the south on the magnetosphere and forcing the current sheet towards a little bit toward the north. And so if you're in the equatorial plane, you're going to be, any time you encounter the current sheet, it's going to be because the current sheet bounced down from further north of you to over you and then bounced back up, if you want to look at it as a flapping current sheet. So after day 200, we started moving into the out of the Saturn's equatorial plane, and in fact, let me go down a couple slides before I talk about that. The next slide just again shows the how well established that period is for electrons, for hydrogen, and especially for oxygen. One of the other peculiarities of what we see is, even though this plasma is all coming from Enceladus, and it's water products, so water products will give you oxygen and hydrogen primarily, maybe some OH. The hydrogen and oxygen don't behave the same. The hydrogen, they both show that period of 10.8 hours, but it's a much better established period for the oxygen than it is for the hydrogen. Another puzzle we don't really know the answer to, but it sure screams out in the data. The next slide shows you a series of these plasma sheet encounters in the magnetic field data and in energetic electron data. And if you click that slide one more time, ooh, that's funny. Never mind.
Oh.
It worked on mine. Anyway, it's not important, but this shows what I was talking about. It shows the Saturn's equator, and the location of the current sheet is in green. The equator is in equatorial planes indicated in red down at the bottom. And then you see a series of these encounters with the plasma sheet, both in the magnetic field data and in energetic electron data. And to get those encounters when you're sitting in the equatorial plane, it must mean that that green current sheet is flapping up and down, popping down to the equator and then back up periodically. So going on to the next slide, this was a special orbit for Cassini because this was the transition from the equatorial orbits to higher inclination orbits. And during this particular orbit, there was a Titan encounter where you see the kink on the inbound path, which changed the inclination of the orbit at that point. The inbound orbit was in the equatorial plane below the nominal position of the current sheet. The outbound orbit was at higher inclination, about the same distance above the nominal position of the current sheet. So this was a good test to see if this was a current sheet that was flapping up and down, which is exactly what Jupiter's current sheet does. Jupiter has an offset dipole, and so the, like Earth, and so the magnetic equator wobbles around as the planet rotates and flaps up and down, and so you naturally get a period of Jupiter's rotation due to this flapping. But if you encounter the current sheet from below or from above, you'll see a 180-degree phase shift between the flaps. In other words, looking at that diagram we're looking at, if the current sheet were flapping or were an offset disk around Saturn and rotating around, you'd see at one phase of the rotation that the disk would be down near the inbound track, and then 180 degrees later it would be up near the outbound track. And so you should expect to see the encounters in the inbound track be 180 degrees out of phase with those in the outbound track. And if we move on, you see a series of encounters on the inbound track from, this is in the magnetic field now and in the plasma data. Everything lines up nicely. And the next one, that's just a repeat of an earlier slide. We can skip that. So that's the one that had the little job. Doesn't matter. This again shows the inbound and outbound tracks. Sorry for the repetition here. This was sloppy editing. But if we move on one more slide, we see what the energetic electron data looked like in FKR coordinates for this inbound track and for the outbound track. And you'll see that the peak in the energetic electron data is not separated by 180 degrees in longitude. It's separated by more like, I don't know, 30 degrees in longitude. And going on another slide, I just basically did a superposed epoch of all that data and averaged it up so you could see it more clearly. So you can see there's a very well-established peak on the inbound track, and then I drew a line where the peak should be on the outbound track if it was flapping the current sheet up and down. This is slide 38. Going to slide 39, you see the peak shifted only a little ways. It's nowhere near where it ought to be if it was a flapping current sheet. So it's not a flapping current sheet. And a lot of people have tried to explain it based on the flapping of a current sheet, but that's not going to cut it. So this cam that's going around in the inner magnetosphere is causing a particular longitude to light up way out in the magnetosphere, presumably due to this ripple that's sending out through the whole magnetosphere. But in fact, you get a stronger pattern out here than you do in the intermediate distance. So.
And just to interrupt real quick, when you say flapping current sheet, which isn't there, that's due to the tilt of the magnetic field?
Yeah, which Saturn doesn't have, so you don't expect to see.
Okay, yeah.
Got to mention this, I think you all know probably.
You see that Jupiter.
Yeah, right, Jupiter's okay. Got a tilted magnetic field. It does flap. Saturn has an aligned dipole. It shouldn't flap, but it does show this periodicity way the heck out there. So people have been trying to come up with reasons why Saturn really has a tilted dipole that's somehow shielded in the inner magnetosphere and appears to be aligned, but is expressed far out in the magnetosphere as a tilted dipole. And what this data says, no, that's not what's going on.
Yeah.
Not a tilted dipole either inside or outside, but it's a very asymmetric field nevertheless. So, moving on. Now, I mentioned that the high latitudes have a different or a complementary tale to tell. We've talked about things happening in the equatorial plane or very near the equatorial plane. This illustrates a series of days of data during which the latitude of the orbit was up at about 30 degrees. So we're well off the equatorial plane now and well away from even the magnetic equatorial plane. And so up here, we didn't know what to expect, but if you go to the next slide, you see a very periodic structure in the energetic electron data. And this is actually one of the cleanest events that we have of this periodicity. It's even better established here than it was in the equatorial plane. So it shows that this communication from the ionosphere out deep in the magnetosphere, because these field lines will map out to crossing equatorial crossing points of 30 or 40 Saturn radii, this period is very well established here.
So real quick, this is on 41, the vertical dash lines, that's the RF?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, but they're all up at the same time?
Yes, those are the spacecraft distances.
Mm-hmm.
The equatorial crossing distance of this field line is even further out than these, because we're off the equator and have a stretch dipole, but it's going to be crossing well beyond this. And at this latitude and for this orbit, we're almost following one field line out. We're pretty much on the same flux tube going out over many days of time. So we're sort of able, it's rotating. It's not the same in the sense that it's we're seeing new flux tubes in a rotational sense, but they are self-similar in the radial sense. That makes sense.
So, but the periodicity really seems to pick up outside of like 12 RS.
Yes, inside of 12 RS, things are weird and different.
Weird.
And that's why we've done our analysis mostly on data from, of this analysis, on data from 20 to 60 RS, because the phenomenology is really repeatable in that region. There's the region from 3 to 5 is special because of the CAM or whatever it is, this density anomaly. From 3 to 12 in the magnetic field data is special because it's got a particular twist in the field that's repeated through that region and is well organized by this coordinate system. From between 12 and 20, somewhere in that region, there's a sort of a real change in the behavior, in the shape of the magnetic field, in the phase of the components. They're still modulated at that frequency, but it's a new regime. It's just a different place there. So the connection there is going to be interesting to understand, whether that connection is translated through the equatorial region, as this CAM appears to be, or whether it's translated through the ionosphere at high latitude through coupling between different latitudes on Saturn. But in any case, there's a real sea change between 12 RS and 18 or so. So, moving to the next slide, this just shows if you took the data from the previous slide and binned it in this SKR longitude system, again, it all peaks, not surprisingly, at around 200 degrees longitude, which is where the electrons peaked in those low latitude passes that I showed you for in the tail. Same place. These electrons are connected to the tail, so they shouldn't peak in the same longitude region. And if you, next slide, line them up on that spiral, it shows the shifted spiral, not the original spiral, and this is the later epoch, which had the shifted spiral. So, again, it's in the northern hemisphere. The data before the shift was in the southern hemisphere. This thing must be some kind of a twist between the In other words, the enhancement shows up at a different longitude in the southern hemisphere than it does in the northern hemisphere, about 30 degrees different in longitude. There's got to be a twisted structure that's rotating around at this period with one hemisphere leading the other hemisphere. Okay, and if I look at one of these enhancements and blow up some data from this is from the Inca sensor, actually. The Inca is an ion-neutral camera. We use it, most of the data you'll see here is from the neutral part of it, but if we turn off the collimator plates, which sweep ions out and don't let them in, then we let the ions in and we measure ions. It's a very sensitive ion measurement, and much more sensitive than anything else we have on the spacecraft. We're measuring energetic ions, and so we can see things at intensity levels that we can't with the other instruments. And you see that there's a well-correlated enhancement in the ions associated with that energetic electron, even at these high latitudes. The little sine waves that are going on underneath this diagram at the bottom panel, that's spacecraft attitude. And we're in one of the downlink rolls here, so the spacecraft is rolling, and you can see a modulation of the ion data at that roll period, which says that the ion data is not the same in all directions. It's got look direction preferences. And if we move to the next slide, you can see that expanded. Now it's a time intensity plot with a whole bunch of different energy channels shown. So we've got the lowest energies at the bottom of this bottom panel and the highest energies at the top of this bottom panel. And you can see on the left-hand side of this panel there's a repeating intensity variation, which is, this is caused by flow of the plasma. As the plasma flows past the spacecraft, if you're looking into the flow, you get a higher intensity than if you're looking away from the flow. So as the spacecraft rolls, you see first looking into the flow, then looking away from the flow, looking into the flow, looking away from the flow. So this is a measure of the flow of the plasma, and it's going around in that same co-rotation direction, but not at the full co-rotation speed. Going slower, it's just like all the rest of plasma does. Then there's this enhancement, which it's much harder to see that flow anisotropy, and it's weaker, the flow anisotropy in the enhancement of the ions. And then the flow anisotropy picks up when it gets down to the weaker intensities after you're out of that part of the ions that correlated well with the energetic electrons. There's another feature in here, which are these little tiny little dots that appear also at the spacecraft roll period and with a very different spectral signature than the rest of the data. Those are beams that are coming up along the magnetic field. They're exactly field aligned, and they are traveling away from Saturn. These are energetic protons that are being accelerated in the auroral zone. And we're seeing these things spit out along the field out and headed for the tail. So we don't know how important a source these are for the general ion population in the tail, but they are energetic and they are intense. They're sporadic. You see them come and go. But they're a fascinating feature of this whole system, and another clue to the coupling between the ionosphere and the magnetosphere. It's that coupling and the slipping in the coupling, the slipping clutch mechanism that generates electric fields and waves that can accelerate these particles at low altitudes, and then you see them flowing out along the magnetic field. So that's all I was going to talk about the energetic particles, and I have a series of conclusions about this, which I can go through or not, or I can just go on. Read these. I've got the energetic. I've got the neutral imaging stuff still to come.
Why don't we go through this quickly, and then go.
So just sort of summarize what I've talked about with the charged particles. All charged particles, regardless of species, that is oxygen, hydrogen, and electrons, the major species, exhibit this strong period at about 10.8 hours, which is the same as the FKR period, and the periodicities are evident over time periods of more than a year. That is, we see them ubiquitously, which all the time we're seeing. Periodicities are evident at both low and high latitudes in the equatorial plane or at these higher latitudes. A regular spiral pattern appears if you map them into these longitude systems that is established by the SKR data. The most recent one is called the SLS system, which is Saturn Longitude System 3. They keep updating the polynomial fit to the SKR data as we gain more time in the mission, so that they can extend the validity of it, because it is a variable system, and you can't extrapolate it very far without getting into trouble. So there'll be a 4 and there'll be a 5 as more data gets added to the mix. Quiet time flows in the magnetotail are predominantly cross-tail in the same direction as co-rotation, but they're well below the rigid, what would be rigid co-rotation velocity. Reconnection flows, flows are much stronger. And I didn't show this stuff, so I'm not going to, shouldn't talk about it here. There's more flows that go on, and I didn't want to get really confused. Field-aligned electrons, and or ions and electrons, probably accelerated in the auroral and subauroral zones, appear independent of the 10-hour and 45-minute periodicity. I didn't point that out on that slide, but you could see those beams, whether you were in the ion enhancement or in the weaker period, they were sort of asynchronous with that. So these, the generation of these field-aligned electrons and ions, these little intense field-aligned beams that are coming out, is not so well organized by this SKR period. They're sort of asynchronous with that. And then the last one, ignore, because we haven't shown you anything on that. Now, the next slide, 47, I'm going to change gears and talk about energetic neutral atoms, and we showed that in the opening slide, some images from that. Energetic neutral atoms are created when ions that are trapped on the magnetic field and gyrating about the magnetic field encounter a cold gas atom, pick up an electron from it, and become energetic neutral. There's very little energy exchange in that process. They just, about 30 eV is a typical energy loss of the ion in that process. And this is an ion that's got 10 kilovolts to hundreds of kilovolts, so it's inconsequential. But what is consequential is that the ion no longer is charged, so it's no longer trapped on the magnetic field, so now it just dips off into space, literally, in whatever direction it happened to be going when that charge exchanged. So it's kind of a random process, and you any place where you have a mix of energetic ions and cold gas density of, you know, certain, you need some threshold gas density to really see emission to get enough intensity. But anyway, you mix cold gas and energetic ions and you will get emission of energetic neutral atoms. So the ion and neutral camera on Cassini was built to produce images in that emission. If you just pretend these things are photons instead of neutral atoms, you can think of this mix emitting photons, and you can take a picture of it. Well, they're emitting neutral atoms, and we take a picture of it just using those as the emission. So, moving on to the next slide, this shows what that mix is at Earth, just to illustrate, because this is where we first started using the technique. At Earth, you've got the hydrogen Gia Corona, which is the extended exosphere. Hydrogen goes up to many Earth radii and falls off with distance from the Earth. And you've got the ring current. Earth's got its ring current. Saturn's got its ring current. Jupiter's got a ring current. When you mix those two, you should get energetic neutral atom emission, and the lower left panel shows what our simulated image of that would look like. If you go to the next slide, this is actually a movie for those of you who have the movie link, and you can see an image of the ring current. The instrument that we took it with, this is not Inca, but it was a clone of Inca, which was flown on an Earth spacecraft, is on the left, and on the lower right you see an image of the Earth's ring current. We've drawn in the limb of the Earth and magnetic field lines, just representative dipole field lines at different local times, at 4 Earth radii and 8 Earth radii, just say something for scale and orientation. And you can see kind of why they call it a ring current. It's a ring, and this is the energetic neutral atom emission from it. And for those of you who had the movie, you could see that it dynamic. It's changing a little over time. A lot of the change that you saw in that series of images was just because of the orbital motion of the spacecraft, but it was also evolving. The intensity was decaying as we went through a magnetic storm and into the recovery phase of the storm. So, using the same technique as Saturn, we actually built and flew the Saturn instrument, the INCA sensor, before we did this one instrument, but this one got data before we got to Saturn, so we sort of developed our display techniques and our understanding of Earth. So if we go to the next slide, this is a little bit of a non sequitur, but this is basically an artist's conception of what the relationship of the ring current to the magnetopause, the bow shock, and the plasma sheet, all things I've mentioned, and the solar wind, of course, just so you can get another view of where these things lie in relationship to each other. The ring current is drawn in orange and sort of extends out into yellow and really goes out to the orbit of Titan. So you see Titan indicated there again for scale. It's not a particular player in the ring current, but it's something that actually I use a lot for a fiducial, just so people can see scale in some of the images that we produce. So the next slide reminds you that you have these trapped particles on the magnetic field lines of Saturn and connecting into the ionosphere. And the next slide shows you another aspect. Remember, for energetic neutral atoms, I said you have to have energetic particles. That was in the artist concept that showed you the plasma sheet and the ring current. This shows you measurements, again, from the UVIS instrument, UVIS instrument. What's that?
Ultraviolet imaging spectrum.
Yeah. Of the emission from, in this case, hydrogen atoms in the Saturn system. Shows you the distribution of cold neutral gas. So earlier I showed you the oxygen gas, which is concentrated much closer to Saturn. The hydrogen gas is distributed much more broadly in the system, and this gives us our kind of medium to charge exchange against with the energetic particles and produce the images that we produce. So we get them both from the oxygen cloud and from the hydrogen cloud. And the next slide shows you a typical image of a Saturn magnetosphere when viewed from the side, in this instance. Sun's off to the right and a little bit below the plane. It's, again, southern summer. And this is an image taken with the ion-neutral camera at Saturn of this mix of the energetic ions in the magnetosphere charge exchanging with that cold gas cloud. You see that it's much brighter on the night side, on the left side, than it is on the day side. That's partly because it is brighter on the night side than it is on the day side, and that's something we found by analyzing a lot of these images. But there's also tends to be a left-right asymmetry in any of these images, and that's because of the rotation. Just as when we were looking at the plasma inside the tail and the spacecraft was rolling, when we looked into the flow, we saw a brighter signature than when we looked away from the flow. Well, the same thing's happening here. The left-hand side of this image is coming toward you. That's part of the rotation that's rotating toward the viewer, and the right-hand side is rotating away from the viewer. That tends to brighten the left-hand side and dim the right-hand side of these images. So you always see this bias for, if north is up, the left-hand side is going to be brighter than the right side, typically. Unless dynamics dominate and you get something that's just so much brighter on the right and so much dimmer on the left intrinsically, in other words, it's not symmetric intrinsically, but it's very asymmetric intrinsically, this effect can be overcome. But in this image, it's just you could think of this as a symmetric ring current, and it looks brighter on one side because it's rotating towards you.
So it doesn't have to do with the way the sun is?
It doesn't. There is an aspect, probably that effect in here too, but the dominant effect in this image is probably just the rotation. We've seen the same thing looking from the dawn side. We've looked at the magnetosphere now from the dusk side as well,
and you see the brightness, the brightest part is on the sunward side there. So it's because that's rotating towards you when you're sitting on the left side. So the next one is actually a movie, for those of you that have the movie. For those of you that have the PDF, there should be some still frames from the movie, which are similar to the ones that were at the beginning of the talk. And this movie shows a bright intensification moving around at a rotation period that's keeping pretty much pace with the pink or purple or whatever, violet arrows, the coordinate system that's rotating with Saturn, and that is the coordinate system established by the SKR radiation. So you see that over several Saturn rotations, there's an intensification in the ring current, and this is the ring current going around. Now, the orbit of Titan is the outermost dashed circle there for scale, and I've also shown the orbits of Rhea and Dione there for scale. Rhea is at about 8.5 Saturn radii, and Dione at about 6, right? So this shows you several features. It shows you that, yeah, you get rotation with the planet, and it's very obvious. It also shows you that inside the orbit of Dione, you get very little emission. It's pretty well empty. And there's some smear in this, and that's just intrinsic to the measurement. It's you know, this is a weak emission, and there's scattering in the instrument, and we only have so much angular resolution and so much counting statistics in each of these images, so they're limited by that. But this is all consistent with basically no emission inside the orbit of Dione, which is, if you can think back that far, that's the empty place where the gas cloud charge exchanged away all the ions, and there are no ions. There's plenty of cold gas, but no ions, so you won't get any energetic neutral atoms. You only get them where you have both. And so this shows, this is the only way we have of getting a truly global picture of the ring current that's instantaneous and you can put together in these kinds of movies. We fly through the ring current all the time. We measure it in situ, but it's very difficult to get this kind of information, what's going on in other parts of the system simultaneously without this kind of imaging overview. It's very complementary to this that you fly by, David.
So how did you get this? This is from way out at Apoapsis?
This is way out at Apoapsis, and this is from a high latitude orbit. So the Apoapsis is I think it should show on here. In the lower left, it shows the coordinates of the spacecraft. So we're at 30 RS, and we're at 52 degrees latitude, local time near 1800, so we're very close to dusk by the end of the movie anyway. And it gives an L value, which is meaningless at this distance and this latitude, but it's very high L. So this is a very good viewing geometry for us. You get to look down, not directly from the North Pole, which would be very nice to do, but hard to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
But any time we're above about 30 degrees latitude, we get pretty good viewing. Saturn's very, very nice for this because the cold neutral gas tends to be confined near the equatorial plane. Not strictly confined there, but it's certainly got a fast fall off above and below the equatorial plane. And the same is more or less true for the energetic particles. You can kind of think of this emission as confined to a disk, and that makes the projection, you know, your ability to interpret what you're seeing much easier than it is at Earth, where you don't have either the energetic particles or especially the cold gas confined to a plane. In Earth, the cold gas is spherically symmetric, so that makes it much more complicated because you the line of sight measurement, the integral along the line of sight, and like looking at an X-ray, if you don't know what you're looking at, and it's a soft tissue X-ray, you have no idea where anything is in relationship to anything else. If you do a CAT scan, you're good, but we can't do that. So, the next slide is actually just that same series of stills that I started out with, series of stills from the movie that shows different phases, actually not from that movie because it doesn't have the pink coordinates on it, but you can see that the time starts out at day 55, 11 hours, and ends up at day 55, 21 hours, 41 minutes, which is one Saturn rotation later, and you see that the intense blob of emission has rotated back to the same position it started out in. Now, again, the background plasma is not rotating at that speed. The background plasma is going at a slower speed. It would take it 11 and a half to 12 hours or even longer, 14 hours sometimes, to get around Saturn. So what you're seeing is a moving in acceleration mechanism, not the plasma going. You didn't just heat the plasma in one place and then let it rotate. It's the heating mechanism that's moving around. So that's one of the interesting things we've learned in this process. The next is another movie, and this is actually during one of the HST Hubble Space Telescope observing periods. You'll see a brightening on the night side, which is the lower right, and then a big intensification in the lower right, which is on the night side, which then takes off and rotates around. So these things are not always just sitting there rotating around forever. And it goes black for a little while the instrument turned down its voltages and then turned them back up. But this is a very complicated structure. If you have followed it at all or were paying attention to what people were doing, the FKR data from other presenters, not me, you wouldn't have noticed that the FKR data is very messy. So they were able to get this very well-defined coordinate system out of it, but the emission is not always from the same longitude. It bounces back and forth by almost a hemisphere in longitude. It's all over the place. It just averages out to one location. And so if you take a long-term average, you get a well-defined frequency. I think the same thing is true with this data, and we haven't fully established that yet, but I think that there's a hemisphere that likes to light up, and it may even be more than a hemisphere. It's more like there's a quadrant that doesn't like to light up. But the location of the brightness can show up anywhere in that region, and it probably just depends upon the particular vagaries of the instabilities in the current sheet that are going on for any particular rotation where it starts up. But it's got a tendency to show up in one small, relatively small longitude range. And once it's established on any given sequence of rotations, it tends to stay in the same place. So I'll move forward again. And what we did with this is, and I'm not going to go through all the text here, so you can ignore that unless you want to read it later. But we did a series of movies in which we, using the actual intensities that were measured, we normalized the data to the peak intensity in each image, so that we were able to follow the peak in the emission as a function of time, regardless of how intense it actually was, and then track that data and find out how these blobs go around and where their peak locations are, how they rotate. And the next slide shows another example where we've got a couple of symbols that show where we located the peak for this particular normalized frame of a movie. And then we track that peak over time and use it you're able to develop statistics on the motion of these things. And the next slide shows what the angular speed of these blobs are. So I'm showing you two examples. I've shown you one example of a movie where the blob was rotating around and it pretty much kept pace with the FKR coordinate system. And then I showed you another one where a blob was created on the tail side and it took off and started rotating. If you follow them in general, some of them go at rigid rotation period, which is where the vertical line is in this diagram, but most of them go slower than that. So they don't actually keep up with the FKR coordinate system, because a lot of them really are created. You accelerate a bunch of particles and then they're locked into the background plasma and do rotate at that lower rate. And this diagram shows that an awful lot of them are rotating at anything from co-rotation period to something well below co-rotation. What tends to happen, though, is that after a rotation, a new blob shows up ahead of the old one. And so, although their velocities around Saturn are too slow to catch, to stay up with the SKR period, you get a new region forming, which reestablishes itself where the old one started in the SKR frame, and then it may keep up or it may drop behind, but then you get another new one that forms eventually. And so if you follow that over time, they tend to form in the same location in SKR longitude, but they often fall back. Some don't. Some stay up, and those are the ones which are probably are keeping a real active acceleration mechanism going the entire time. The ones that are falling behind is where that acceleration mechanism sort of peters out. You're left with the particles that are still glowing and still going around, but dying because nothing's sustaining them, and those will rotate at a lower speed, and then you knock off a whole bunch of new ones ahead of, in phase of the ones that it dropped behind. And if you go, the next slide just shows a bunch of derived co-rotation velocities from both the CAPS instruments and our MIMI instruments, showing that in general, the dashed line is where rigid co-rotation at the SKR rate would be, and everything tends to go slower than that. Now the next one, just there for to show you the process we went through to try to analyze this statistically. When we were looking at the system from more or less from the side, we took repeated frames. I'm having a hard time explaining this. We normalized them spatially, so each rotation spatially, and so each vertical stripe in one of these images is a particular image compressed horizontally and stretched to the same distance vertically, so that regardless of how far we were from Saturn, we stretched it to the same size. And then, so this is, you can look at this as just a bunch of stacked images turned on edge over time, over many days. This was our best example. We had about 7 days of continuous viewing and rotation, which is very unusual. This was before the probe drop-off, when they weren't allowing the spacecraft to articulate. So it was happened to be when we had good viewing, so we got a nice steady view. I'd love to go back to another period like that, but that won't happen. Anyway, if you stack all these images up over time, and then you draw a line down the middle of them, and down the middle should be where Saturn is. That's the center of them. The reason we did that is because of this day-night asymmetry that's imposed by the rotation. We didn't want that influencing the analysis, so we took a cut right at Saturn, where the velocity of rotation is neither toward you nor away from you, and so you should be able to see more or less undisturbed intensity variation. And if you follow that line across here, you'll see that you're going to get a periodic result out of it. And then if you analyze the period of that on the next slide, you see long periodograms based on that data. And what you see is something I mentioned earlier, that the hydrogen is very poorly organized, but the oxygen is extremely well organized. I haven't shown you any movies in oxygen because they're really not very good. The oxygen gets scattered very badly in the instrument, and for reasons I can't get into now. But anyway, we can't get good images in oxygen. However, we can follow the intensity variations in the oxygen quite well. And what this shows is that the oxygen is just very well organized, and it's right at that 10.8-hour period in the energetic neutral atoms. Now, that's not too surprising. We showed that we got that in the energetic particles, too. But recall, the energetic particle data that we had analyzed was between 20 RS and 60 RS. This emission is happening between 8 RS and roughly 20 RS. So this is the middle magnetosphere. This is that region that includes this transition between 12 and 20, which is all weird and screwed up. That weird and screwed up stuff may be what's accelerating the particles. It's going to be a lot of twisting of the fields. It's going to be a transition from a dipolar to a stretched disc-like field. It's a very dynamic region, and we get a lot of particle acceleration there. what this seems to indicate is that the oxygen responds much more effectively to this periodic acceleration mechanism than the hydrogen. They both do respond to it. You can see it clearly in some of the movies, but if you average over time, the hydrogen's really not, that doesn't fall out very well, whereas in the oxygen it falls out very well. Okay, and then the next slide just shows if you follow the periods, the peak period in these long periodograms over a couple year period, you'll see that the oxygen sits right on that SKR rotation period, and the hydrogen is all over the place. Mm-hmm. Sort of averages out to the same, but it's messy. And then, so this really generates more questions than it answers, but some of those are, why do the energetic neutral atom signatures, as well as many others, SKR, energetic particles in the 20 to 60 RS region, magnetic field 3 to 12, plasma density between 3 and 5, show a persistent periodicity at a well-defined, slowly varying frequency? This is a very broad range in radius. It's a very broad range in latitude that it connects to the ionosphere. The coupling is fairly strong to the ionosphere at low latitudes. It's fairly weak at high latitudes. Why do we get exactly that same frequency? I mean, if you look at the co-rotating plasma, it gets more and more sub-co-rotating the further you go out. So it shows the coupling's weaker and weaker, and yet this frequency is rock solid throughout the magnetosphere. It's still a puzzle. The driving mechanism must be only loosely coupled to the interior. That is, we're not looking at the interior rotation period of Saturn, which, even though the FKR from Voyager used to be used as the interior rotation period of Saturn, I think we're pretty convinced that's not the case. The driving mechanism is not likely bound to the magnetosphere. Plasma velocity doesn't keep pace with the disturbance. And so the ionosphere has got to be where it's all connected, but you've got this coupling between different latitudes is still a real open question how that occurs. And then the next slide, is there a preferred latitude in the ionosphere that couples closely to a magnetospheric feedback loop that then reinforces the disturbance at that latitude? So if you have an ionospheric conductivity anomaly, how do you maintain it? Well, one way of doing that is if you have a conductivity anomaly, it will result in a longitudinal variation in field-aligned currents that run out into the magnetosphere. Those field-aligned currents then communicate from the ionosphere to the magnetosphere, trigger an instability in the magnetosphere that can accelerate particles, and the pressure variations created by the accelerated particle can reinforce that same current system feeding back to the ionosphere and further ionizing the ionosphere in that location. Then you got a feedback loop that may be established and may connect the low altitudes to the high altitudes and also may spread it to different latitudes. But that's still a hypothesis. Southwood and Corona have both come up with other mechanisms that I haven't gone into here. We still don't have an answer, but energetic particles, especially oxygen, tend to be energized on every rotation, preferentially at a particular SKR longitude, and probably preferential in local time as well. That's less well established. This is likely caused by a current structure that I was just describing, set up in the magnetosphere by your choice, ionosphere, unbalanced load, which is what I call Zondernet mechanism for the heavy side. People put the question to him, well, why that longitude? And he said, well, some longitude's got to do it. It's like an unbalanced load in a washing machine. And you spin it, how to decide where to put the, how to balance thing. It's just a random perturbation that can start it up, but once you start it up, it can amplify. Let's see, and probably not a magnetic anomaly. If it was a magnetic anomaly, it would have to be tied to the interior and therefore couldn't vary in frequency the way this does. It triggers an instability in the middle magnetosphere and energizes particles. So I think I've got some more here, but I think I've probably pretty much worn it out. The next is another nice movie, which if you want to view, you can. It's more of an edge-on movie and goes on for a number of rotations. It was really the first time we had firmly established it in this data. And let's see if there's anything else here. Now, I'm going to stop here. I could go on for quite a while. But
okay. Well, this is great, though. Thank you very much. It's quite a, looks like quite a big topic and quite a lot still to unravel.
There's a lot.
There's a lot of different aspects.
I could have just talked about the stuff that we really know, but I think that's less exciting than the stuff that we, we're still trying to figure out.
Do people on the line have questions? I think I'm going to ask one. I have a couple questions, but I think I'll just ask one. And that is, since it does seem like such a big problem, you know, like such a big system and so many aspects to it, what do you think would be the best way to, you know, if you had your dream spacecraft and your dream instrument, what would you do to try to get at this whole big problem?
Well, my dream spacecraft would be at least two, maybe three. First of all, this energetic neutral atom technique benefits greatly from having at least stereo viewing because you've got line of sight integration that your intensities that you're looking at, and So with a stereo view, you constrain the problem much more, and you can tell where along the line of sight a particular intensification is going on. I would certainly want a next generation of instrumentation that would have higher sensitivity and higher angular resolution so that we could resolve some of this stuff better. Right now we're seeing these big blobs, and we can't resolve any kind of active regions within them that may be, you know, that you may gain information. But the other thing we'd like to have would be to have in situ data complementary to the energetic neutral atom. So it would be nice to have a viewpoint from high latitude,
looking down.
Looking down the system at the same time that you're in orbit and finding out what's going on locally, so you can start to one of the things that we haven't made much progress on so far is connecting these very dramatic intensifications that we see in the ring current that are rotating around with what we see when we fly through the system. We see lots of stuff, we see lots of injections, but we don't usually see things that we can establish are on the scale that what we see in the energetic neutral atom images. We see a lot of smaller scale stuff, but these very large scale structures are not things that we have been able to identify in the situ data well.
I have a question.
Yes.
When we're watching the rotation around Saturn, if I had it figured right, it looked like it was coming towards us on the left and going away on the right, but it was red on the left and blue on the right, which seems, does the Doppler effect not a consideration here, or how do I have that figured wrong?
Let's see, I'm not sure I followed your question entirely, but I think what you were saying was that you were seeing when these things were rotating around that it was brighter on the left as it was coming toward you, and then dimmer or more toward the blue on the right as it was going away from you. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, and that's why I was wondering. It seemed, unless I have something figured wrong, it seemed like coming towards us, so the red shift, it should be just the opposite there. But
okay. Yeah, sorry. That's a bad choice of color bar, I think. Red is just more intense, and blue is less intense. It's not a measure of the energy of the particles that we're looking at.
I see.
So, what we're really looking at is a cut in energy. We're looking at a specific energy band. So on the left and right, we're seeing the same energies because that's what the instrument is choosing to look at.
I see.
and then as they're coming toward you, what's really effectively happening, as it's coming toward you, you're moving lower energy particles into the passband of the instrument because you're adding the velocity of the flow to those particles. And as you're looking on the right, where the particles are going away from you, you're moving higher energy particles into the passband that you're looking at, that energy band. And so the variation in intensity is because there are fewer high energy particles and more low energy particles.
I see. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Any other questions out there? Okay, well, Dawn, thank you very much for a really interesting talk. And everybody online, please tune in to the next Charm Telethon on February 26th, where we will hear about the latest results. It'll be sort of the Huygens third anniversary Charm Telethon. We'll hear about the latest results from the Descent Imaging Instrument team. So thanks, everybody, for calling in, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.